We're on the beginning stages of really a change in how we consume energy, and it's in the world's interest that we promote biofuels. Where the United States needs to go, though, is that we can't rely upon corn only to develop our ethanols, and so we're spending a lot of money on cellulosic research.
On cellulosic research. Okay. Oh, my God. Good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on Nova M Radio Network. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Bush wrapped up his whirlwind tour of Asia amidst heavy security and thousands of anti-Bush protesters, which means we have moron sounds on the program for you tonight. And a rather weird statement from Henry Kissinger, one of the architects of the attack on Iraq. Kissinger has been making mischief on this planet for about 600 years now. Bush in Vietnam was bad enough. I got the Times this morning. And I open the newspaper, and there on the front page is Bush and who else? Putin, and I believe the Chancellor of Germany, and I think the Australian Prime Minister. I'm not sure who the woman was. She looked like the one that Bush had snuck up behind and goosed at an earlier meeting. But there stood the heads of state dressed in Vietnamese ceremonial garb, and Bush, of course, is leaning over, saying something to Putin, and you can tell by the expression on Bush's face that it's something snide and sneaky and probably dirty. Now, I don't know how much English Putin understands. It is safe to say that Bush understands nothing in Russian, so God only knows what was being said. But that photograph was bad enough. There it was, Bush. No offense to Vietnamese traditional dress, but there's Bush in a gown looking like a total moron. And then when you jump to page, was it A12 or A14, there's a picture of Bush and several Vietnamese people, one of whom is apparently a waitress, as identified by the caption under the photo, giving him a hug. And he's got that goofy, hey, do I squeeze your boob look on his face that he's had on his face since he was at Yale, I guess. I don't know. I can't. Sometimes it is very difficult for me to just get through the New York Times, especially when I see those pictures of Bush. It's astonishing. How did this happen to us, us being America? How in the world did this freak out? Well, of course, we know how. The election was stolen. The voting was stopped. Oh, my God. So anyway, he leaves Vietnam. And while he was in Vietnam, he made a couple of little side trips, very quick ones, one of which was to that restaurant where he met the Australian Prime Minister. John Howard, is it? And had a bite to eat, but his trips outside his bubble were almost non-existent. I read a couple of reports that said he might have spent all of 20 or 30 minutes looking at stuff and things, or looking at things and stuff. The man is absolutely without any interest in anything other than what goes on his dining room table, I guess, at lunch. It's unbelievable. Here's this man standing in a country with whom we engaged in the longest war in American history. A war in which nearly 60,000 of our people were killed, 2 million of their people were killed, hundreds of thousands of people wounded and maimed and having Bush there just seems to add further insult to injury of the whole god-awful mess. There he is, shuffling and grinning and shucking and jiving like some kind of a minstrel clown. How did we get this guy? So he bailed out and went to Indonesia. Or, no, he went to Indonesia first. Or did he go? I don't know. It really doesn't matter. But on protesters in Indonesia were waiting for him. I guess he went to I don't know. Protesters were waiting for him in the Indonesian capital, chanting, "We hope Bush dies." You know, not death to America, not death to the great Satan, not death to the great Satan in Israel, not Yankee go home. No, 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 no. We hope Bush dies. Holy Jesus, they didn't even say that about LBJ, did they? Or Nixon, or anybody. We hope Bush dies! Now, this was Bush's second visit to Indonesia. Neither time has he spent the night, or even more than a few hours. Yeah, I went to Indonesia. Damn, man. Well, it's democracy in full flavor, cause flower or something, because they, you know, they hate me there, so they're out in the streets demonstrating. Man. Second visit to Indonesia. Neither time has he spent the night or even more than a few hours. Now, ostensibly, that's a result of security concerns in a country where emotions about U.S. policies in the Middle East and the Iraq War run hot. Emotions? According to the International Herald Tribune, Bush emerged from a black 4x4 vehicle in front of the palace. And that's where we're going to have some sound for you here in just a minute. This is from today, the Indonesian Bogor Palace. In Bogor, Indonesia, obviously. International Herald Tribune says Bush emerged from a black 4x4 vehicle in front of the palace, followed by his wife Laura, after earlier being whisked by helicopter from the Halim Military Airport in Jakarta. The U.S. president shook hands with Indonesian officials and entered the building to begin more than 6 hours of meetings with the prime minister and civic leaders. Bush was not expected to interact with the general population or do anything outside the confines of Bogor Palace. And we know why that is, don't we? Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation, is an important ally in the U.S.-led war on terror in the region, but both the government and much of the public oppose U.S. policy to the Middle East. Oh, yeah, they are great allies of George Bush's war on terror. Sure they are. When an act of terror occurs in a part of their territory, as it did in Bali, they will make arrests, they will put people on trial, and they will execute them. But it has nothing to do with Bush's war on terror. We hope Bush dies! Is what the Indonesians say. In the lockdown town center of Bogor, which is about 30 miles south of the capital of Jakarta, most streets had been cleared, some blocked with razor wire and water cannon. Hundreds of police with riot gear stood at the ready, along with small groups of armed soldiers. Nonetheless, about 1,000 anti-U.S. protesters ignored monsoon rain and thunder to chant, "We hope Bush dies!" in front of Bogor's telecommunications center after breaking through an outer ring of police barricades. Every place this man goes, lockdown city center, cops, police, paramilitary, submarines, tanks, fighters, bombs, jets. Good God. We'll have some comments from Chuckle Nuts here from Bogor Palace in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
War a go-go, there's plenty good money to be made, supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, they drop it on a Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, generals, let's move fast.
Perhaps the most important lesson that I learned in Vietnam is that you cannot fight a guerrilla war with conventional forces.
Yeah. Okay. All right, now through the magic of something, we are going to join Mr. Bush during the press availability in Indonesia today. He was with President Yudhoyono of Indonesia at the Bogor Palace in Bogor, Indonesia. Now, Mr. Bush did look kind of worn out by the end of his whirlwind visit with the leaders of the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia, or as Chuckle Nuts calls them, I went to China. Hey, man, I was Chinese. He looked kind of puffy in Indonesia today. Of course, that might have been all the Kevlar under his business suit and the wads of cotton in his ears to drown out the cries of, "We hate you long time!" from the hordes of protesters outside Bogor Palace. So a visibly shaken and exhausted Chucklenuts stepped up to the flower-laden podium with the Indonesian presidente and answered a few questions after insulting a member of the Indonesian press first. Reporter begins, "I would like to ask you, as you mentioned before, Indonesia now is growing toward democratization. And how do you think the process of democratization in Indonesia, the process of democratization is going?" And, Mr. Bush, I have a second question.
How many you get to ask here in Indonesia? How many questions you get to ask? That's keep firing away.
Well, lots of Indonesians think that you have a hidden agenda going here.
Oh, yeah?
Such as securing your Exxon deal in Natuna. And what is your comment on that?
Well, we didn't discuss it. No, we did not discuss it. You asked about Indonesian democracy. Here's living proof right here.
Or her.
The president kindly hosted a meeting today with civil society leaders, which points up to the diversity of this great nation. Different religions, different backgrounds, different people, all united under a democracy. And so I would say your progress is very good. But we all have work to do in our respective democracies. You know, our transition to democracy wasn't all that smooth in America. If you study American history, we had some rough go for a while, and it's hard work.
What? Well, what? Oh, my God. She asked about your smarmy little crappy-ass little deal with Exxon. Oh, God. And right out of the bat, you know, the woman has a couple of questions. She says, "How many you get to ask here in Indonesia?" "Well, with six, you get spring roll, Chuckle Nuts. Now shut up and let the lady ask her questions. This isn't like reporters in Iraq. You can't have them shot." Or run over by Humvees if you don't like the question? Bush says, how many get you asked here in Indonesia? And the reporter says, excuse me? How many get you asked? Oh, keep firing away. Don't want to say that, chuckle nuts. Not in Indonesia. Someone might not understand American idiom, but do understand American idiot. Well, Mr. President, lots of Indonesians think you have a hidden agenda going here.
Oh, yeah?
You know, like securing your Exxon deal in Natuna. What's your comment on that?
Bite me. Who are you?
How'd this girl get in here? I would say your progress to democracy is very good.
Oh, thank you, Mr. President. You do approve.
And it's hard work.
W wouldn't know hard work if it ran up and gave him a deferment.
Hard work?
Moving along. Now that the obligatory, meaningless, hard work tributes to Bush-style democracy and adroitly sidestepping questions about the tentacles of Exxon, you know, now that that's out of the way, Bush fell into his comfort zone with a question from an American reporter. Terry somebody. We'll have it for you when we come back. This is astonishing. Can you imagine the Indonesian reporter, after she leaves this phony-ass little photo op and goes outside and says, that's the leader of the free world?
Creeping while the children die. Cronyism spreading. Come on, Obama, wedding boy. You've been a naughty gal. You put your weapons down. I am the con man. They are the con men.
Welcomed, but it was not a peaceful welcome.
And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk.
26 before the hour. Bush in Vietnam and Indonesia. Unbelievable. Back to Bogor Palace in Bogor, Indonesia. And as I mentioned right before the break, the obligatory, meaningless, hard work tributes to Bush-style democracy and sidestepping questions about Exxon oil deals are now out of the way. So Bush gets into his comfort zone with this question from an American reporter named Terry. I'm not sure it is. Terry somebody. The question is, Mr. President, you've talked about the dangers of leaving Iraq too soon, but you haven't talked about what risks might be involved in adding tens of thousands of troops to secure Baghdad, as Senator McCain has suggested. What are the downsides, if any, for that approach?
Terry, we haven't made up, I haven't made any decisions about troop increases or troop decreases, and won't until I hear from a variety of sources, including our own United States military. As you know, General Pace, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is in the process of evaluating a lot of suggestions from the field and from people involved with the Central Command as well as at the Pentagon. And they will be bringing forth these suggestions and recommendations to me here as quickly as possible. But there's no need to comment on something that may not happen. But if it were to happen, I will tell you the upsides and downsides.
Just like you keep us informed truthfully on, your Rumsfeld decisions, right? Are you listening to him? Do you hear how detached? Do you hear how the Zoloft or whatever it is he's taking? It's just got control of his mind. Isn't there an amendment to the Constitution that prohibits this? That when chief executive is this drugged? Back to the fun questions from the Indonesian press, like this one about alternative energy sources. At least Bush doesn't yell at this reporter or try to embarrass him or order him to bring some more of those little dumplings. Reporter says, President Bush, relations between the United States and Indonesia are strong. And as you said, the United States is a longstanding partner of Indonesia. As you already know, Mr. President, Indonesia is currently developing alternative energy. Are you willing to cooperate in this area? And can the United States share its technology with Indonesia and help us? Now, listen to the comment about cellulosic research.
It's important for us to develop alternative ways to power our vehicles if we want to become less dependent on oil. The other interesting fact for people to understand is that the technology to have a gasoline-driven automobile be powered by ethanol is very simple. It's called flex-fuel automobiles. And so we're on the beginning stages of really a change in how we consume energy, and it's in the world's interest that we promote biofuels. Where the United States needs to go, though, is that we can't rely upon corn only to develop our ethanols, and so we're spending a lot of money on cellulosic research, and that is the ability to convert wood chips, for example, to ethanol.
Oh, God. There's no T in that big word, raisin brain. Nice try, because it was a very big word. You got real close to saying it all so good. Do you hear him? Do you hear him? The Indonesian reporter is talking about technology and alternative energy sources, and this moron starts talking about gasoline! About cars! Well, I don't know. Do I have to answer this crap? I want to go home. Christ, I've been on the road for 4 days, something. Finally, a reporter cuts to the chase and asks Bush about the thousands and thousands of angry protesters that he faced on this trip in general and in Indonesia specifically. President Bush! Here in the world's most populous Muslim nation, thousands have demonstrated for days saying that your policy in the Middle East, in Iraq, and elsewhere is anti-Islamic. How do you fight that impression? Doesn't it require more than just reassertion of your existing foreign policy goals? Maybe it's the dry drunk in him, but Bush is inexplicable, Bush inexplicably started yammering about Methodists and living in moderation.
My answer to people about whether or not, you know, how do you comfort people of the Muslim faith that our policies are, you know, open, is that I believe
what?
Freedom is universal and democracy is universal. I don't believe it's the sole right of the United States or the sole right of Methodists.
What?
I believe in the universality of freedom. And I believe people desire to live in free societies. And I believe the vast majority of people want to live in a, you know, want to live in moderation.
Oh, my God, these pearls of wisdom from the draft-dodging Coke boy. Oh, my answer to people about whether or not, how do you comfort people of Muslim faith that our policies are open? I don't know what that means, but I have a suggestion, Chucklenuts. Maybe you can stop killing them? Maybe there's some comfort there. I know. Let's stop killing them? Hi, we're going to stop killing you. Yeah, I believe freedom is universal. Do you hear how he's... Listen to it one more time. This is the question about... the reporter says, President Bush, here in the world's most populous Muslim nation, thousands have demonstrated for days, saying that your policy in the Middle East and Iraq and elsewhere is anti-Islamic. How do you fight that impression? Doesn't it require more than just reassertion of your existing foreign policy goals?
My answer to people about whether or not, you know, how do you comfort people of the Muslim faith that our policies are, you know, open, is that I believe freedom is universal and democracy is universal. I don't believe it's the sole right of the United States or the sole right of Methodists.
What?
I believe in the universality of freedom. And therefore, and I believe people desire to live in free societies. And I believe the vast majority of people want to live in a, you know, want to live in moderation.
Want to live in moderation? What the hell does that mean? See, we're all too busy to pay any attention to this. I didn't hear any of this. I have no idea what this freak is doing out there saying on behalf of the United States. I have no idea. You know why I know? And you know? Because Kathy pulled these sound bites. We don't know what the hell is being said.
I want some more. I want to go home.
Dateline, Bogor, Indonesia. A prominent Indonesian black magic practitioner joined protests yesterday against President Bush's visit, slaughtering animals as he cast a spell aimed at disrupting Mr. Bush's stay. The ritual by Ki Jendeng Pamungkas took place at a busy traffic circle in this hill town of Bogor that is to host talks between Mr. Bush and Indonesian President Yudhoyono on Monday. Mr. Pamungkas said the ritual, which involved killing a snake, a cow, and a crow, and a goat, used Haitian-style voodoo because Indonesian black magic does not work on foreigners. The witch doctor offered prayers to Satan, who will bring disasters on Bush's visit. My curse, the man said, will make him bloat like broccoli. Bush will feel unease during the visit. Asked if he was confident the hex would work, Mr. Pamungkas said, I've put voodoo curses on white men in Indonesia before, and they all died!
You know, I think it's high time that more Methodists try curses in moderation. Freedom is universal. It doesn't just apply to Haitians and Methodists.
Okay.
Everyone wants democracy.
Okay. Cellulastic.
Cellulastic Methodists.
I'm waiting for someone to email me and say cellulastic is really a word, Mike, and here's the definition. It's you who is stupid, not a glorious president. Cellulastic. What did he say? I know we're running short on time here, Kathy, but can you please play that one again? Where is that one? That is when we come back. And so we're spending a lot of money on cellulastic. Oh, Jesus. But do you notice? It's not just me, is it, Truth Seeker? You notice the kind of dreamy quality, the Paxil, maybe it's opium. I don't know. That quality. I had a dream last night.
I think a useful tool of foreign policy for our country is try to let the sun shine in. I like the idea of people growing corn that gets converted into energy. The more corn there is, the more we have to eat. The more corn there is, the more energy there is.
Okay, there is something called cellulostic ethanol. It says here, back in July, some Dartmouth College engineers engineered a bacteria originally found in Yellowstone National Park Hot Springs to convert cellulose into ethanol in a much more efficient manner than previous methods. They say it should make for ethanol that is as cheap or cheaper than gasoline, and have set up something called the Mascoma Corporation to make it into a big business.
sounds like a joke, right? But my good friend Clint in Michigan sent this to me. It's from flaminggrasshopper.com, which is a reputable website. Cellulastic. There is a cellulastic, apparently.
Okay, so here he is again. Just listen to it one more time. This is where he says, if we want to become less dependent.
It's important for us to develop alternative ways to power our vehicles if we want to become less dependent on oil. The other interesting fact for people to understand is that the technology to have a gasoline-driven automobile be powered by ethanol is very simple. It's called flex fuel automobiles. And so we're on the beginning stages of really a change in how we consume energy, and it's in the world's interest that we promote biofuels. Where the United States needs to go, though, is that we can't rely upon corn only to develop our ethanols. And so we're spending a lot of money on cellulostic research, and that is the ability to convert wood chips, for example, to ethanol.
Okay. The point here is, it's a lie. Of course we should be switching to some sort of biofuel. Of course we should. Just two questions ago, reporter asked him about the secret deals with Exxon. To do what? Dig for corn? Burn wood chips? I don't think so. Plunder and pillage more of the islands of Indonesia looking for more pools of underground? Yes, that's probably what they're talking about. Of course we need biofuels. That's the answer.
How much is the Bush crime family spending on government-financed research? As a percentage of the overall budget? No, not a percentage of the overall budget. As a percentage of or factor of the amount of money spent on death and destruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. What would you guess, truth seekers? 1%? 1/10 of 1%? 1/100 of 1%?
All right, I have just one more. We got time for Kissinger, for Dr. Death. You got to love how one of the chief architects of the so-called war on terror in general and in Iraq specifically now tries to distance himself from that bloody stain on U.S. history, especially today. One of the bloodiest yet in Iraq. Over 50 people killed, I think, just in Baghdad. Seems like Kissinger thinks it's time Iran and Syria took over control of Iraq. Why should they clean up our mess? Didn't Raisin Brain label Iran one of the axis of evil countries anyway? Something? Do you realize, Truth Seeker, what Bush has done to us? Anyway, a BBC news person, I believe it was in an interview that was conducted in Australia. The news person asked Dr. Death if it was possible to have a military victory in Iraq, as Bush keeps demanding.
My answer to people about whether...
No, not that. Let's try the other one.
If you mean by clear military victory, an Iraqi... government that can be established, and whose rig runs across the whole country that gets the civil war under control and sectarian violence under control in a time period that the political processes of the democracies will support. I don't believe that is possible.
You have to excuse me. I have a Cambodian stuck in my throat. And so you people laugh, some of you, when I say this son of a bitch is 700 years old. Do you, when you listen to this guy, do you have any doubt that he eats babies? That he travels the world? I like Cambodian babies. And from Chile, they're good, although they tend to stick between my teeth. I wonder if someone can please get me a fresh glass of blood. There seems to be a hair floating on this one. Welcome back. It's about 7 past the hour. For some reason, it seems appropriate to mention that O.J. Simpson's book and special on Fox News, both apparently have been canceled. As was pointed out on ABC News tonight, though, the special, the interview was already taped, and the book has already apparently been written by, not by Simpson, but by a ghostwriter. And rumors have it the 400,000 copies were ready to ship, so it'll show up eventually. But apparently it was even too much for a whorehouse operation like Fox. Last night, was this last night on David Letterman? Letterman's top 10, the top 10 chapter titles in O.J. Simpson's new book. Number 10, People on My To Kill List. Number 9, Tuesdays with Robert Blake. Number 8, The Murder Weapon. Is it hidden in your town? Number 7, 101 Alibis for All Occasions. Number 6, guitar lessons, ballroom dancing, and other things I've taken a stab at. Number 5, How I Killed Pat Morita. Number 4, My Confession, I Love Pop-Tarts. Number 3, Things I Want to Do Before I Go to Hell. Number 2, It's Not Like I'm Blaming It on the Jews. And the number 1 chapter from O.J. Simpson's new book, If Murdering Two People is a Crime, Then Call Me Guilty.
From Letterman's program. Regarding Iran, it was the French news agency, AFP, put this out on Sunday. I haven't seen this in American media yet. A classified draft CIA assessment has found no evidence of a secret drive by Iran to develop nuclear weapons, as alleged by the White House. According to a top U.S. investigative reporter, of course that would be Seymour Hersh, writing in an article for the November 27 issue of The New Yorker magazine, which was released in advance, Hersh reported on whether the administration of George Bush was more or less inclined to attack Iran after Democrats won control of Congress last week. A month before the legislative elections, Hersh wrote, Vice President Dick Cheney attended a national security discussion that touched on the impact of a Democratic victory in both chambers on Iran policy. Hersh wrote, citing a source familiar with the discussion, quote, if the Democrats won on November 7th, the vice president said that victory would not stop the administration from pursuing a military option with Iran, end quote. Cheney said the White House would circumvent any legislative restrictions, quote, and thus stop Congress from getting in its way, end quote. Can you believe this? I don't have any adjectives or curse words that are admissible on over-the-air broadcasting. It's just astonishing to me, this beast that is the Vice President of the United States, having engineered the theft of the office twice, this beast who says, no, we're going to attack and murder and kill and slay. Anyway, Cheney knows he's dying. Cheney knows his heart could burst any day. And that, I guess, kind of gives him the idea, well, you know, screw it. I'll take as many hundreds of thousands with me as I can. You know, these Muslims have their 70 virgins. Well, my suicide attacks are going to give me hundreds of thousands of people to accompany me into the great beyond. That's what it seems like. This guy is a true beast, just an absolute non-human. We don't care, he says. We don't care. We don't care. We don't care about the legislative process. We don't care about checks and balances. He's using the royal we. We also don't care about George W. Bush. It's just astonishing. The French news agency said the Democratic Party victory unleashed a surge of calls for the Bush administration to begin direct talks with Iran. But the administration's planning of a military option was made, quote, far more complicated, end quote, in recent months by a highly classified draft assessment by the CIA that, quote, challenges the White House's assumptions about how close Iran might be to building a nuclear bomb, close quote, Seymour Hersh wrote. Hersh added the CIA found no evidence of a secret Iranian nuclear weapons program running parallel to the civilian operations that Iran has declared to the International Atomic Energy Agency. A current senior intelligence official confirmed the existence of the CIA analysis and said the White House had been hostile to it. Cheney and his aides discounted the assessment by the CIA, according to this official. The CIA official was quoted as saying, quote, they're not looking for a smoking gun. They're looking for the degree of comfort level they think they need to attack Iran. End quote. And our new Democratic Party leadership says impeachment is off the table. These are perilous times, thanks to primarily to Dick Cheney and this moronic fool that occupies the office of the presidency. It's incredible. One other item here. The Senate's next Republican leader, that's Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, is threatening the Democratic-led Senate now, bipartisanship, that he will make sure any legislation written by Democrats would be blocked if the Democrats refuse to allow confirmation votes on Bush's judicial nominations. In other words, if the Democrats use the system the way the system was designed to prevent the appointment of, oh, I don't know, Nazis to the federal bench, then McConnell will play dog in the manger. He will squat over the manger and relieve himself so that the Democrats can't get their legislative agenda passed. This was all said at the Conservative Federalist Society annual meeting this past Friday. McConnell told them not to feel bad about the Senate election results because Republicans will hold 49 seats in a body that requires 60 votes to end the filibuster. McConnell told the Federalist Society, which are absolute neocon thugs, quote, if the Democrats want our cooperation, they'll give the president's judicial nominees an up or down vote, end quote. No, that's not the way it works, Mitch. That's not the way it works. That's what the Senate Judiciary Committee is all about. And if the Senate Judiciary Committee says no, then there is no up or down vote. It's called the rules of the Senate. And if you don't like them, Mitch, why don't you get out, you pig? Democrats said McConnell's comments were nothing more than posturing. Jim Manley, spokesman for Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada, said, quote, the president should stop picking fights and start working with Democrats to pick nominees who can be confirmed. Now, the thing that is infuriating about the Democrats and Mitch McConnell, two words, Alioto and who's the new Chief Justice? Oh, my God, two words. Roberts, Alito, Alioto? Oh, my God. I want some of what Bush has been smoking. Alito and Roberts. The Democratic leadership in the Senate made no effort, none, to stop the ascension of these two Nazis to the United States Supreme Court. What the hell does, well, what do these Republicans, this purely rhetorical question, what do they want? The Democrats in 6 years have done nothing, nothing to resist the move by the Bush crime family to turn the judiciary in this country into nothing more than a rubber stamp for a neo-fascist executive branch. And McConnell has the absolute audacity now that the Republicans are out of control, out of power, he has the audacity to threaten the Democratic leadership. Well, tell you what, if you don't continue to pass the judges, we will pee all over your legislative ideas. Huh? You like that? How's that? Huh? You like that? Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I hate these people? We'll be right back.
For a liberal helping of truth, it's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 22 past the hour. Before we come to your phone calls, there's something I want to share with you. This is for real, and my good friend and colleague in this crazy talk radio business, Peter Werby, introduced this to me via the website globalorgasm.org. Now, before you freak out, let me
Let me explain what this is all about. There is a project at Princeton University, the Global Consciousness Project. Their website is http://noosphere.princeton.edu. And this project at Princeton University runs a network of random event generators around the world, which record changes in randomness during global events. And the results, according to Princeton University, show that human consciousness can be measured to have a global effect on matter and energy during widely watched events, such as the attack on this country on September 11th, the Indian Ocean tsunami. There have also been measurable results during mass meditations and prayers. Now, the science behind this dictates that the zero-point field or quantum field surrounds and is part of everything in the universe, and it can be affected by human consciousness, as can be seen when simple observation of a subatomic particle changes the particle state. We all know that. If just a slight familiarity with quantum physics, like I do, just a tiny, I can barely define the term, but I read Science Times and the New York Times, and over the years I have read that there are certain observations of certain, let's call them for the sake of argument, subatomic particles in quantum physics, just the observation alters the reality of that, quote, particle, end quote, or wave, whatever you want to call it. So at globalorgasm.org, they say, we hope that a huge influx of physical, mental, and spiritual energy with conscious, peaceful intent will not only show up on Princeton's random event generators, but will have profound positive effects that will change the violent state of the human world. Now, what they're talking about, the event that they're talking about, and this is for this coming solstice, Friday, December 22nd, month away. This involves all men and women, you and everyone you know. Where do you do it? Everywhere in the world, but especially in countries with weapons of mass destruction. When? On December 22nd, winter solstice day, that's Friday, December 22nd, at the time of your choosing, in the place of your choosing, and with as much privacy as you choose. And why? To affect positive change in the energy field of the Earth through input of the largest possible surge of human energy, a synchronized global orgasm. There are two more U.S. fleets heading for the Persian Gulf with anti-submarine equipment that can only be used against Iran. So the time to change Earth's energy is now. Now, whether or not you think this is nuts, crazy talk or not is, that's your choice. But I find this kind of interesting. Globalorgasm.org is the website if you want to check this out. In their index, the science behind it is this is an attempt to influence the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University. So check it out. I mean, why not? Right? Hey, if it doesn't work, it'll be fun trying.
Need some wood?
Religiously, I'm speaking on the science, cause we gotta live on science alone. I tell you what, mathematically, I'm having it. I wanna live.
Now, everybody, have you heard? If you're in the game, well, then the stroke's the word. Don't take no side. You got a thirst for killing. Take your mind.
Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
It's about 25 before the hour. I guess it's the holiday season, right? Oh, by the way, if you're keeping score here, the Molloy program is only going to be on tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday this week. Thursday and Friday on Thanksgiving, there is, I think, the KPHX and down the line over the network is going to broadcast the first show that we did when we came back on the air after a two-month hiatus. And then on Friday of this week, I'm not sure, maybe Kathy, do you know, Kathy?
Well, in honor of the Christmas season and all things tiny baby Jesus, they're replaying our Halloween show.
Oh, no, that's on Friday? So Thursday, Thanksgiving, yeah, like anybody will be listening, you know.
Everyone will be at the mall. Come on.
I'm talking about Thanksgiving. I will be so far away from a radio on Thanksgiving. I probably will be listening to one of the local jazz stations or something, you know, just some background music. But if you are near a radio and really want to get into some self-abuse on Thanksgiving, tune in Thanksgiving night, same time, same station, and on Friday night, same thing, you know. Should be fun. Reg emails in regarding the O.J. story, the latest edition of the O.J. story. Reg writes, I'm kind of amazed at the outcry against the O.J. book, which I think is commendable, she writes. The outcry is commendable. He killed two innocent people quite brutally and got away with it. And so much of the nation has rightfully shown its outrage. Murdoch himself and the advertisers and the bookstores and several Fox affiliates and wonder of wonders, even Bill O'Reilly, all agreed that a murderer, even if not convicted, deserves to be an outcast among us and not a hero. So how is it that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and all the PNAC thugs don't stir up this sort of horror in the psyches of the American public? They've killed and maimed hundreds of thousands of innocent people, and they're getting away with it. Go figure. Yeah, I guess, you know, who was it? I'm just rhetorically saying who was it. I think it was another one attributed to Stalin. You know, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Or a number or something. I don't know. I'm really not very good at remembering famous quotes. All right. The last thing here from electiondefensealliance.org. electiondefensealliance.org. And this comes to me by way of Brad Friedman's Brad blog. Major miscount of vote in this election just passed. Reported results skewed toward Republicans by 4%, 3 million votes. What they're saying here is the Election Defense Alliance is asking for a further investigation into the election results of the election just passed and a moratorium on deployment of all electronic election equipment. After analysis of national exit polling data indicated a major undercount of Democratic votes and an overcount of Republican votes in U.S. House and Senate races across the country. If you'll go to this website and read this report, they are making it very clear with the science and the proof to back it up that what should have been a Democratic Party landslide was once again skewed. Now this does not come as news to you or to me, but here is the proof, if any is needed. Go to electiondefensealliance.org and find the miscount of vote in the 2006 election. I think it is a given that this election was supposed to have resulted in defeat of Democratic candidates. It was a given
that this, once again, would be a 50-50 election or a 48-48 election with the 4% swing one way or the other, easy to manipulate by the programs in these voting machines. Well, it didn't happen that way because so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Democrats and independents finally said we've had enough of this drift towards Nazism and went to the polls. But the attempt was made regardless. And the attempt is going to continue to be made with every single election that we have in this country until these machines are destroyed. Until every single Diebold and ESS and whatever the other company is, until those machines are gotten the hell out of the democratic election process in this country. Until that time, every single election will be set up for theft by these filthy Republicans. The website is electiondefensealliance.org. It's like Greg Palast said, they tried to steal it. But we just showed up in enough force to overwhelm their illegal vote theft activity. All right, let's do some phone calls here. 800-989-1480 is the number. And there's four open lines, so if you want to get it on the program tonight, let's do it. 800-989-1480. Let's start with Matthew, who's calling from Bedford, Texas. Hey Matthew.
Hey, you know, if any of Bush's aides had an ounce of patriotism in them, which, I mean, they don't, while he was in Indonesia, one of them should have just tapped him on his shoulder and said, "Hey, Mike, I mean, hey, George, these people like you here. Why don't you just go on Rome Street? You know, people like you. They'll just kind of wave their guns at you a little, but, you know, they'll just kind of learn to accept you."
Yeah, well, I think even to a moron like Bush, it was clearly apparent that the people in that country wanted him gone. One way or the other.
I think, well, what country doesn't want him gone?
No, that's true. That's true.
Second thing, I wanted to know, and this might sound like a stupid question, but I know I'll trust you to set me straight if it is. What do you think, aside from the obvious differences as we've seen, is the difference, do you think, between the 1994 election when the Nazis took over and the 2006 election when the Nazis kind of lost it? What is the difference to you, anyway?
In what regard? You mean in the number of voters, in the number of Republicans who came in 94? What? There are a lot of ways that question could be answered.
Well, I guess I'm assuming in regards to the public opinion of, I mean, it's obvious that in this election, as you said, it was the Democrats saying we've had enough of the sway to Nazism. But what could have compelled, aside from general stupidity, the American people to vote for a conservative House and Senate just after they voted for a Democratic president?
I've been stymied by an answer to that, except to say that it was at that point in 1994 when the religious fanatics in this country, the religious right, the political religious right, and the Federalists and the political neo-Nazis led by Newt Gingrich all kind of came together at the same time and decided that the time was then to seize, if they could, control of the legislative branch of government. They pretty much had wormed their way into the judicial branch during Reagan-Bush 1. Now they wanted control of the legislative branch. And Democrats were asleep at the wheel. Democrats had been in power for 40 years. The Democratic members of Congress were asleep. And the Democratic voters never thought that this country could really see a surge of neo-fascism coming out of their churches, coming out of their local Republican Party headquarters. I mean, Republicans were Republicans, a little bit wacky, a little bit crazy, a little bit tacky, but certainly not willing to respond to the neo-fascist screamings of a freak like Newt Gingrich. But Democrats were surprised. And I think the difference between 94 and 06 is that in 06, the Democrats now have had a chance. I'm not talking about elected officials, but just Democrats in general. We've had 12 years to see how bad the Republican Party is. They cannot govern. What they do is destroy individual liberty. They impose an agenda that is invasive, that is religiously fanatic. And I think the American public finally woke up and said, okay, that's it. No more. You boys had your 12 years. Sit down. It's back to the back of the bus with you. So that's the best I can do on that one. I have to leave it there. Thanks, Matthew. I appreciate you checking in. You take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Mike Malloy Show, because each time you listen to right-wing radio, God kills a kitten.
Fat Charlie the Archangel sloped into the room. He said, I have no opinion about this.
It's about 10 before the hour. Back to your phone calls. Bernie is calling from Seadrift, Texas. Hey, Bernie.
Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Doing fine, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Wanted to ask you about the, you covered so many topics this evening. How about Bush's first official mission to Vietnam?
Yeah, I think he failed.
Well, yeah, I think Uncle Ho would have been prouder to see him about 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
So how do you feel about our new tour of the house in January?
In what regard? I'm not sure what you mean, Bernie.
Well, with the Democratic takeover of the House and Senate.
Well, I think it's a good idea. On the surface, let's see if the Democrats can do something with the fact that America has come to them and said essentially, "Please save us."
Well, that's right. I'm down here in the Texas 14th. We kept our incumbent now, I think, for his fifth term, Representative Ron Paul, who voted against the war in Iraq, against domestic surveillance, against the Patriot Act, extension, against the Military Tribunal Commission. If I could only get Dr. Paul to come around to the social side of the issues, I think I'd go with the GOP.
Well, he's not really a Republican. Ron Paul always has been libertarian. As a matter of fact, he was a libertarian candidate for president back in, 86 or 90 or sometime back then. And I guess Mr. Paul just got tired of losing elections running as a libertarian or an independent, and decided to run as a Democrat and started winning elections. But he is, as a Republican. He started running as a Republican, and once he started doing that, he started winning elections. But his position on every single issue is the libertarian position. The fact that it matches up in a lot of respects with the positions of the Democratic Party is not a surprise. Democrats have been labeled as being intrusive or the nanny party or the mommy party or whatever right-wing drivel these Republican operatives have hung on the Democratic Party. But there's so much about Democrats that is libertarian. For example, and this is an example, a woman's right to privacy. That's a libertarian point of view. Another example, the decriminalization of marijuana. That's a libertarian point of view. Well, both of those issues are also Democrat. Democrats are far, far, far more closely aligned with libertarians than Republicans ever could be. Now, Republicans have skewed the issue. They have lied by saying we're the party of small government. No, they're not. They're the party of big intrusive government. They've said we're the party of this and that and the other thing of decency and integrity. No, they're not. They're the party of liars and counterfeiters and thugs and killers and purveyors of a fake murderous foreign policy. So yeah, Ron Paul with his libertarian ideas is much closer to the Democratic Party than he is to the Republican Party. So I wish he would just come out and declare himself a Democrat and maybe use his ability to cut through the BS on so many issues and kind of educate the Democrats on certain issues. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, exactly. And I think he should. If you look at some of the Democrats we have down here, like Henry Cuellar, the kissy kissy Bush guy from, the guy's not a Democrat. I mean, he's like worse than a Joe Lieberman kind of a Democrat.
No, I understand. I understand. Yeah, sure. Well, I've never met Ron Paul. I talked to him one time interviewed him when I was on an Atlanta radio station a million years ago when he was still a libertarian and running for president. And there's a lot of libertarian, a number of libertarian ideas that perfectly dovetail with Democratic, capital D, ideas. And Republicans have evolved into the party of control and intrusion. You know, Ron Paul would never and has not gone along with something like surveillance of Americans' telephone calls, or
NAFTA or CAFTA,
right.
The Trans Texas Corridor, the Super NAFTA Highway going on up to Kansas. That's right. I see everything other than his social positions and spending money on any kind of a social program.
Yeah,
he's 100% my kind of guy.
Well, except for what you point out. I mean, the one problem I have with so many libertarians is they preach a kind of utopianism that they think society is huge as ours, 300 million people, can somehow exist with zero government intrusion except, the one or two areas where libertarians say it's okay, which is the protection of the nation and I forget what the other one is, but you can't run a nation like that. You can't have 1,000 different companies building roads and using whatever numbering system they want. There has to be some sort of central, if not control, certainly authority over what we do. A libertarian idea says get rid of all regulatory agencies. That's insane, because the free market may determine that we don't buy a certain brand of meat anymore, but only after 17,000 people die of food poisoning. That's nutsy.
Exactly.
Hey, thanks, Bernie. I appreciate what you had to say. You take care, all right? I think Ron Paul is a very interesting, very charismatic politician. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Welcome back. About 7 past the hour. The phone number here is 800-989-1480. What else we have on the agenda here? Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go back to your phone calls, all right? Starting with Dave, who's called in from California. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Dave.
Glad you're back on the air, man. Love you. Missed you.
Thank you, sir.
Listen, all this talk about pulling out of Iraq, you know, surely you're aware, and most of your listeners are, of the, you know, the project for the new American century.
Right.
And these neocons, if they've gotten a foothold in Iraq, that's been their plan. That is their gas station.
Yeah.
They're not leaving Iraq, ever, okay? They're already, as you know, pumping their oil with no meters on the line. They're already profiting from the Iraqi oil. They were supposed to pay for this war with that oil. That, of course, was a joke. And, you know,
yeah,
already...
yeah, I seem to remember something about that, right? Who was it? Cheney said that the war would be paid for? Or,
oh, yeah, sure.
God, I hate him.
Mm-hmm, right. They're already talking about bringing the draft back. They're building the permanent bases in Iraq. They're spending, you know, God, what do they want? Just call for what was yesterday? Another $170 billion or something they're calling for?
Yeah.
Look, the thing is, the war profiteers are running the country. You know, they're the ones that are making the money. This is the big money grab.
That's right.
And they're not leaving. The only way we're going to ever get out of Iraq is if we get a new president. Hopefully, you know, you just talked about the voting machines and such.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully, we can prevail in the presidential election, or cut their funds off. And I don't think the Democrats are going to cut their funds off. So, for the next 2 years, all we can do is, you know, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and let's face it. These boys are all dying for nothing, the same as we did.
I know.
And there's nothing going to change. And they're talking about, Bush is talking about, we got to win the war. What are you going to win?
Yeah, he's he or anyone else who talks that way is displaying insanity. I mean, just craziness, pure and simple.
I know.
Crazy.
I hate him as much as you do. If I start yelling, forgive me. But the problem is, Mike, is how are we ever going to live this down? I mean, the shame that these Republicans have brought to the United States of America in the last 6 years, this is not beyond belief. This is a nightmare. Am I going to wake up? What's going on? This is beyond belief. You know, we're the imperialists now. We're the Nazis. You remember the Nazi Germany? One of the reasons they lost the war was they ran out of gas. So these grandsons of the original Nazis, fascists, first thing they're doing is grabbing the oil fields. They're not going to run out of gas this time.
Uh-huh.
It's the same thing playing out again. It's the same neocons that didn't call them that after World War II that wanted to invade Russia and take over the world. They are still at it, and they will not stop.
Well, I can't and disagree, Dave, with what you're saying. I just hope that... That somehow, I'll tell you what will get us out of Iraq quicker than what you're suggesting. And it would require tremendous courage on the part of the people who would have to do it. And that would be for the highest levels of the U.S. military to sit down privately with the civilian leadership of this country. And you and I would have to never know about it, because if the truth ever came out, it could be seen almost as a nonviolent coup. But if the highest leaders of the military would sit down with the highest civilian leaders in Congress and say, okay, we've got to stop this, no matter what you have to do to stop it, cutting off funds will give you guys an awful lot of bad publicity. We are willing to go along. We will step out and say we want to pull our... You see what I'm saying? Because Dick Cheney and the PNAC people and the stupid marionette, George W. Bush, and the rest of the people who now run the United States government, they couldn't care less about soldiers dying, and they don't give a tinker's damn about the reputation of the United States. They believe that might makes right, just like Hitler did, just like Stalin did, just like Mao did, and you can do anything you damn well please. So I see the only way out of this, short of what you said, and I don't know if this country can handle two more years of this war, would be for the highest levels of the military to sit down with the leadership of the Democratic Party in Congress now and say, look, we've got to bring this to an end. That's the only out that I see. Dave, thanks for checking in, pal.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
All right. Katrina is calling from Brooklyn. Hey, Katrina, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
I'm still laughing about the voodoo joke.
The voodoo, the Indonesian okay. priest? I don't know what he was. I thought all those people were Muslim, but I guess not.
But what I was going to say, I'm on a lighter note tonight. I guess the voodoo worked after all. Because Air Force One's tires blew up didn't go down today. So,
you're kidding. I didn't hear anything about that. They couldn't lift off? What? I mean, I didn't
hear
about
this. When they landed, they had to get another tire.
Really?
Really. So I guess there's something to this voodoo. So we need to get the same man and bring him to America so he could use this on the PNAC people next.
anything to put to put the quietus, as they say, on these neocons, I'm in favor of. Even if it means I have to relent a little bit and say, okay, there is a higher power. I don't know if I can do that. But.
We need to sum it all.
Yeah, really.
Mike, I love you, and I'll call you next week.
Thanks, Katrina. Take care. Have a good Thanksgiving. Rich is calling from Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Rich,
hey,
welcome to the program.
Mike, it's so good to hear you. I was jonesing off you not being on Air America for the last 2 months.
Yeah, well, we're back.
And you're better than ever, man. First of all, I want to tell you, thank you as a Wiccan for the respect you pay to me and my pagan brothers. Okay?
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm looking forward to hearing the rebroadcast of your Halloween show on Friday.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question before I talk about the Wrangle thing with you. What I wanted to ask you was, now that Bush went back and played Kissy Face with Communist Vietnam 38 years later, do I get to call him Hanoi George?
You would think, wouldn't you?
That's
the part I said in my little mini blog at my website today. I can hardly stand this because... Bush dancing around with the Vietnamese government, and a couple of years ago, Colin Powell dancing around with the Vietnamese government, because they could have danced around with the Vietnamese government 40 years ago. All Uncle Ho wanted was for his country to be left alone. They decided to go communist. The people of Vietnam, in the chaotic state that nation was in after World War II, if they didn't want communism, there was a way to make that clear. And after hundreds of years of being invaded and dominated by the Chinese, the Japanese, the French, and then the United States, the Vietnamese people said no, 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 and it could have been so easy to just not have gotten involved, but we were involved in the so-called Cold War. And look at us now. Look at it now. Look what's going on now, Rich. We're signing trade agreements. We're going to Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon, whatever the hell they call it, and we're butting up and we're pals. In the meantime, I said this last week, that wall in D.C. with those 58,000 names is just shaking and shuddering. Every single night this winter when it gets dark in D.C. and the haints come out, that wall is going to just move back and forth from the power of those 59,000 men who died for nothing. And I'll tell you something else, the ghosts in Vietnam, the 2 million people that we murdered in Vietnam, I don't think, now I'm talking like a fool, I understand that, but I just don't think those ghosts are going to rest quiet. This is awful. I can't believe this.
Absolutely right.
All right, Mike. You wanted to say something else, and I went off here. So hold on a second. You
okay.
want to talk about Charlie Rangel's draft proposal, so stay right there. We'll come back after the break. I'm Mike Malone on Nova M Radio.
exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting?
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
I can remember these songs when they first came out. I know a lot of our listeners can also. And I just, you know, I thought, wow, you know, those are pretty powerful songs, and they're going to disappear. And they sound dated now, don't they? But they're still, sadly, they're still relevant. All right, we were talking with Rich. Rich, you wanted to bring up, I think, Charlie Rangel's draft proposal point.
Yeah, Mike, both Randy and Sam today devoted a lot of time to it, and I really got off on it because, like, this thing that Randall's proposing, this reintroduction of this bill when the Democrats take control of the House, this is a political no-brainer for the Democrats to throw this up in the Republicans' face, because what Rangel's saying, and it's so clear that what he's saying here, is that if you want to continue this war, you better have pony up the troops. Nobody, they're not reenlisting. Now, my respect to Dave, who was on before as a Vietnam vet, I respect him. I was drafted during Vietnam in 71, too, but I had a 4F for a military disability, okay?
Uh-huh.
And, I was on the other side anyway, so I'm glad I didn't go, okay? But the thing is, there's no difference. I mean, it's the same old again. It's just a waste of time, money, and human life, like you were saying. And what Rangel is saying is put up or shut up time for the neocons and the Bush lovers who want this war but don't either want to pay for it or put any known skin in the game. And if the Democrats don't jump on this with both feet and make this right in the floor, this war is not going to end anytime soon. They got to push the envelope now and raise the stakes, and Rangel is doing a very good strategic move bringing this up for debate, because this is going to put it right in Bush and Cheney and all the neocons and debt dealers' face. You want this war, you pay for it, you fight it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Rich, thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
All right, appreciate what you had to say. Let me add to it, as a matter of fact. What the neocons, the neoconservatives, the Federalist Society judges, the Project for a New American Century thugs, what the Elliot Abrams and Dick Cheney's and the rest of these people, what they were hoping for, please keep this in mind, was a total privatization of the United States military. Total privatization, where just as the hardware is secured through private corporations, whether it is General Electric or Boeing or whatever the company is, the hope of the neocons was that eventually the armed forces could also be secured and maintained through private corporations. They want to privatize everything. Remember that. Especially the fighting machine that will go work for the neocons, for what they hoped would become the United States government. Now, the fact is, and I'm saying the fact is, what I have read, I don't know if it's fact or not, from several reliable sources from the left and the right, that there are as many as 30,000, maybe higher, private military contractors at work in Iraq. These are guys that answer to no one. They do not answer. They are stateless in terms of their ability to wage war. The very same people that the Bush crime family, or the very same type of people, the Bush crime family says we have a right to scoop up and put into military prisons and call them enemy combatants. Only these people are Americans. They work for private corporations. They do not wear uniforms. They do not operate for a sovereign nation. They are independent contractors. Would it not be fair and just and proper for them to be scooped up by some other nutball like George Bush is or Dick Cheney is, and placed in prisons where they would be put in front of tribunals if they were ever put on trial, and if they were executed in private, which is what Bush wants to do, what Cheney wants to do. So we already have as many as 30 or 40,000, I believe the number that I've seen batted around, private military operatives working in Iraq. This is insane. This is insane. If we are still at a point where we feel it necessary to have a military, whether that military is to be used offensively, which is the way it has been used for the past 150 years, or defensively, which is how it's supposed to operate in theory, it doesn't make any difference. Then it has to be shared by every single draft age person in the United States, not unlike what Israel does. Everybody who reaches a certain age goes into the military, period, unless you have a medical condition that keeps you out. It doesn't make any difference your race, religion, your social strata, your income, or what class you come from. Your ass goes into the United States military when you reach a certain age. Now, if you don't want that, then we have to do what the framers of the United States Constitution had in mind when they did everything they could to prevent the existence of a standing army.
I made it very plain. We will not have an all-volunteer army. And yet this week, we will have an all-volunteer army.
Or not. Or yeah, or wait, wait a second. What, huh? What the... What the... The leader of the free world. There he is. Mickey is calling from Dahlonega, Georgia. Welcome to the program, Mickey.
Hi, Mike. I just want to make a quick comment, too, about how much has changed in the last 6 years. When September 11th happened, there were a million people that gathered in Tehran holding up candles of vigil.
That's true.
And now we're the most hated country in the world. But what my call is about is we talk about how much we're going to watch the Democrats, how we're going to make sure that they do what we put them in there to do. But what if they don't? What's the alternative? If we vote them out, the alternative is the Republican. So as you were talking about framing the other day, the framework of the government hasn't changed. The money that still flows to these two parties through the military-industrial complex and the corporations, how can we address this?
That's a fair question. That's one I've been asking for the past 6 or 7 or 8 years when it finally became clear to me what, of all people, George Wallace said back in 1968. There's not a dime's worth of difference between these two parties. And my answer was we've got 2 years to see how these Democrats that we've now put in office, how they govern. If they continue to do what you've just pointed out, respond to the dictates or the money of the ruling class, whether it's the military-industrial complex or a broader definition of the ruling class, if they do respond simply to that, then we're going to have to bite the bullet and start working for true liberal Democrats from the ground up. And there's a risk there that we will fail. And if we do fail, then we've lost it. You know, I said the 2 or 3 days after this last election that Democrats should not be sitting back on their butts applauding and saying, we won, our team won, yup, yay. You know, nonsense. We've made a tiny baby step in stopping temporarily the slide to fascism. Now it's up to us, the people who put these Democrats in office, to stay on them like white on rice with emails. Well, that doesn't work. Forget emails. With phone calls, and don't send letters because they're afraid of anthrax now. So phone calls, online petitions will sometimes work. Hounding these people when they come to their home districts, when they come back home, whatever the district is, to for a fundraiser or to report to the folks back home, for Democrats to be there and say, now, wait a second, you know, you're not doing what we elected you to do. We've got to keep the pressure on. I think, and I realize this is a long answer, Mickey, but I'm trying here. I think what we've done in the past We put Democrats in office, and we say, okay, Democrats, you're in office. Now we can go watch a football game. We can't do that this time because you're right in pointing out that waiting in the shadows is this huge neo-Nazi Republican machine just waiting to make that final move for democracy or representative government in this country is over. So the only answer I have, pal, is we've got to keep the pressure on these Democrats. And if they don't respond, then we're going to have to throw them out of office and take the chance that we've lost the whole game. I don't know what else to say, man.
Well, I think that the three big things that we could probably work on and put the pressure on most, one, the voting machines have to go.
That's true. That's very true.
Second, we need to get rid of that damn Electoral College. I think.
Well, that's true in presidential elections, but that really doesn't.
Oh, right. I mean,
it really doesn't affect the legislative branch directly. But no, I still agree with you. I still agree with you.
And I think third, we have to have, and I think everyone's been screaming this, but no one does anything about it, is just election reform with financing.
That's right.
And, unless we get these three things, I really don't see how we're going to end this cycle.
I know. I hear you loud and clear. Mickey, thanks. I appreciate your point of view.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Thanks for checking in. That's one thing I can say I've been saying for a long time, that. You know, if I were king of the world for a few moments, not only would I disallow any sort of television or radio political ad, which immediately reduces the amount of money candidates need by about 80%, but I also, the two other things I would do, corporations or businesses could not contribute a dime to any sort of political activity whatsoever. Elections, canvassing, get out the vote, nothing. Get the hell out of it. You're a corporation. You're not a human being. Get out of it. And the third thing would be absolute, utter public financing. If a candidate wanted to run for office, that person would have to raise the amount of money, and he'd have to or she'd have to really work hard to do it. It would mean going to the YMCAs and the YMHAs and the civic associations and the temples and the mosques and the synagogues and the churches and the school auditoriums and going door to door, and that candidate would be exhausted. But remember, the budget required for such a thing would be reduced by an enormous amount because we've already eliminated any radio and television ads altogether. That money is no longer applicable. So the candidates, as they go about house to house, school auditorium to school auditorium, saying, vote for me because, they also pass the hat at that moment and use the money for what? Since it's not going to be used for 30 and 60 second lying spots where it appears that the people we do send to office are the worst human beings on earth because of or in our society because of negative advertising. What are they going to use the money for? They use the money for voter drives, get out the vote, maybe print up handbills that say, this is what I represent, this is what I stand for, this is what I'll do in office. Now, I realize that sounds very, very politically naive, doesn't it? Huh? Listen to Mike Malloy talking like it was 1925 or something. I said that's what I would do if, you know, when I'm king of America, that's what I would do to the electoral system in this country. Caller's right. It's screwed. The money that has gotten into our political system has totally, utterly destroyed it. It's not completely dead yet. It's utterly destroyed. And if we want to get it back, he's right. The voting machines, campaign finance reform, and I would take it to the next step and say that not a dime, not a penny by any corporation, by any business, organizations that are collective bargaining units for human beings, like, oh, I don't know, let me think of one, unions, if they want to get their people together and all chip in a buck, fine. But corporations, any kind of, no, absolutely not. The corporations already own everything. They already dictate everything. Screw that. Everybody from Jefferson to Ben Franklin to Abraham Lincoln to Teddy Roosevelt warned us Dwight Eisenhower warned us repeatedly over and over and over and over again of the corruption, of the corrupting influence that corporations could play or affect in our political system. We have been warned for 200 years, and now here we are. And for some reason, we have elected people that weakened those warnings. We had a Supreme Court ruling that said, no, a corporation is the same as people. What the hell kind of nonsense is that? So it's right now it's a crapshoot. Are we going to maintain and sustain representative democracy in this country, or are we going to lose it? It's a roll of the dice, truth seeker. Deb.
Hello.
Is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I want to mention three things, and I better talk fast before you kick me off.
okay.
I know how you operate there. Last week you had a Republican strategist for J.D. Hayworth from Arizona, and he was mentioning how he knew that the 2000 elections were rigged, and he wanted to bring it out in the open because he's seen the light. Well, I called a call-in show of our local call-in show, and Bev Harris was on from Black Box Voting, and I told her about what this guy said, and she said, have him contact her, and she'll give him the right people to go through to bring this all out, and if he does know more people about it, she'll help them too, and we can get this all straightened out. She said we only have a year to straighten this all out before the 2008 elections.
Uh-huh.
Second thing I want to mention is, does anybody know that Bush bought 100,000 acres in Paraguay?
Yeah, I saw a couple of online stories about that. I don't know exactly what it's about.
I'm mentioning it so people hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if he's like trying to run away from the world court in 2009.
Oh, he just might be doing that.
And there's supposed to be this really long landing strip there, and on the property.
Yeah.
And there's a military base right nearby that he fixed it where the soldiers that do war crimes would have immunity. So I don't know what this is going on that he's up to. But
I don't
suspicious.
Either. I'm going to have to get a hold of my good friend Alex Jones and find out what this is about.
Yeah.
All right, Deb, thanks.
Can I mention one more thing? About the Military Commission Act and the concentration camps, what's that all about?
Yeah.
I just want to bring it out, and maybe somebody could Google it.
All right, we'll do it. We're out of time. Thank you. I appreciate it, Deb. Take care. About 10 before the hour. Thanks to our Phoenix crew tonight, all one of him, Ian Huff, who engineered the program, also associate produced. Well, good for him. I mean, he did a hell of a good job, too, didn't he? Chris in Minnesota is our senior correspondent. Mark Marshall is our webmaster at MikeMalloy.com. And also thanks to our moderators there who run the message board. Ben Birch archives the program, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And as you know by now, podcasting and downloads of The Malloy Show are available at NovaMRadio.com. Bob is calling from Detroit. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing, Mike?
Doing fine, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to just say that, first of all, there's a lot of talk about either pull out or a phase withdrawal. My question is, if you take, they don't have enough there already. If you take some of them out, what is the people left there? How are they going to defend themselves? They don't have enough people to back them up. That's the first point. Second point on the Charlie Rangel thing about bringing back the draft. Didn't we try? Didn't we do that with Vietnam? Wasn't it a conscription during Vietnam, and he still got away with that?
Well, yeah, but the way it was, the way the draft certainly was set up in the Vietnam era, is there were all sorts of ways to avoid the draft. Look at George Bush. Look at deferments, divinity students, for example. If you were studying for the ministry, not a conscientious objector based on your opposition to war, but if you were in certain fields of study, if you were studying to be a school teacher or a minister, you could apply for and get a deferment. If you were...
And you also have conscientious objector, too. Conscientious.
Well, there's always been conscientious... well, not always, but I mean since, as far as I know, since World War One or possibly World War Two. Mm-hmm. But the draft in the Vietnam era was so patently unfair. People like George W. Bush could get into these champagne units and never leave the country, while other people who weren't well connected would have to go fight. I think what Charlie Rangel is saying, and Rangel is a wounded, decorated veteran of Korea. So this is a Charlie Rangel's a combat veteran. He's no fool.
And I was in Vietnam.
All right. So Rangel has seen combat, unless I've got that all wrong, and I don't think I have. I think Rangel is a combat vet, and all he's saying is two things. First of all, let's get our cards on the table. If an administration in this country wants to wage war, we can't do it where it's on the backs of either private military, that's insane, or a few people who had joined the reserves of the National Guard to serve their country, but understanding that they would serve their country here at home. Unless the country was invaded, they would not be in a combat situation. If you're going to have a foreign policy that is aggressive, militaristic, warmongering, then you're going to have the backing of all your people. And that means everybody, black, white, Jew, Gentile, rich, poor, gay, straight, are going to have to contribute their sons and now their daughters and their fathers and cousins and brothers and pappies and mammies and the whole lot if that's what you're going to do. Now, the obvious alternative is to have a military whose sole function is the defense of the United States, period, end of story. Now, a lot of people listen to that and say, oh, Jesus, there he goes again with his utopian naivety. No. Sorry. We live in a world now where, you know, somebody says the word froggy and nine other countries jump. And the idea of having an aggressive, militaristic foreign policy like Bush and the rest of these suckers do means that absolutely Americans are going to die for nothing. So Charlie Rangel's point, I think, is a good one. If we're going to have a government that insists on sending people to war, then the pool from which those people are going to be drawn has got to be a universal pool. Everybody gets in or nobody gets in.
But nothing is absolute. There's going to be loopholes. They got the rich people out there who are going to find their way around it.
Well,
you're going to be stuck back where you were now.
Well, you legislate those loopholes away. That can be done. It was done in World War II. The only people who got out of service in World War II were people, I think, unless I'm wrong on this one, were people who literally, absolutely could not serve because of a physical disability. And a lot of those people wound up serving in a non-combatant position. So there's ways to close the loopholes if we have the determination. Of course, my belief is, what the hell are we doing in the year 2006 deciding issues by force anyway?
And that's why I don't think that Rangel is going to fly, because in 2006 we're asking questions that we was asking back during the Vietnam and World War II. But now, what about then the people leaving the Vietnam, leaving Iraq, part of leaving and rest staying back? You're leaving sitting ducks back in that country if you even pull out part of it.
I think there's a way to withdraw. We did it. We did it in Vietnam. We let the enemy that we've created know that we are leaving. We strategically withdraw. There's also, I believe, I'm not a military tactician by any means, but I do firmly believe that there are ways to do it. In a way that it's not, it doesn't just become a shooting gallery. You understand
what I'm
saying?
My point is, though, we need to get out. If you're going to withdraw with the intention of steadily withdrawing, not withdrawing with the intention of saying, okay, we're going to leave this force in here just to promote our ideology.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get an argument from me with that one. Hey, Bob, I got to leave it there. Thanks,
sorry,
pal. I appreciate you checking in. I hope to hear from you again. Thanks for your participation tonight, however you did that. All right? I do appreciate it. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio Network.